Good evening. Welcome to the Salir Report. Today is Thursday, November 8th, 2018. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. I'm in New York City tonight. It's my last evening here, and then I'm headed back to Hickory Valley, Tennessee tomorrow. Travel plans for the rest of the year, all by car. I'm headed over to the Texas Panhandle for Thanksgiving with a stop in Oklahoma City on the way back, and then for Christmas up to Pennsylvania for a few days, and then when I get back into the heartland to interview Dr. Farrell at the end of December. Lots of special reports up on the Salir Report. Alan Phillips on vaccines, Aaron and Melissa Dykes on their wonderful new documentary, The Minds of Men. It's a must watch. So if you haven't had time to watch it, Thanksgiving and the holidays will be perfect. Then One on 5G by Michael Blanchum, or with Michael Blanchum. Go back into the archives also. We have a great interview with Jason Bowden-Smith on 5G as well. And then I'm hoping to get Bowden-Smith back in 2019 because we need to do more conversation about how we protect ourselves. And I did some great interviews when I was in Europe, and we'll be publishing those between now and the end of the year as well as special reports. Also, I just want to mention we have a great new review of the Oscar race, some of the Oscar race contenders in the new Food for the Soul column. Our theme tonight is the U.S. midterm elections. The Democrats won the House, but Trump won the election. I want to spend a fair amount of time on the elections tonight. That's going to be my primary focus because I think it's sort of important to recap what just happened. This is a midterm election. We had all 435 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives up. The Democrats gained 30, enough for them to get the House majority. Not all the votes are counted yet, and it looks like we're going to have some real squabbles about voter fraud, so we have one or two more races to be sorted out. 35 of the 100 seats in the Senate were in contention this time around. The GOP gained 3, more than expected, so now the Republicans have a clear majority in the Senate. This is important because the Senate is the place where appointees get confirmed and judicial appointments get confirmed. So this gives the Republicans a much stronger sort of situation than they've had for the first 2 years of the current administration. In addition, you had 39 state and territorial governorships being subject to election, as well as numerous state and local elections. The Democrats gained 7 governorships, but the Republicans still have a majority. And the Democrats also gained about 330 state legislators. Now, let's look at midterm elections. There have been 27 midterm elections between 1910 and 2014. In those 27 midterm elections, in 24 of them, the president's party lost an average of 36.5 seats. So it's almost standard operating procedure for the president's party to lose during the midterm election. Again, there's only been 3 midterm elections in that entire period when the president's party gained, and the average loss was 36.5 congressional seats. There's only been 5 times in the last 105 years that an incumbent president has won seats in the Senate in the off-year elections. That's from Ben Stein. To give you a counterpoint, in Barack Obama's first midterm in 2010, Republicans picked up 63 House seats and 700 state legislative positions, whereas Democrats lost 6 seats in the 2010 midterms. So you could say that Trump significantly outperformed Obama and outperformed the average. So I posted a story from the Washington Post, which I rarely post, from entitled "The Democrats Won the House, But Trump Won the Election." It was a remarkably good analysis of what had happened. And it finished with the emphasis on the fact that Trump has a base which is real and strong. If you look at how he performed in the rallies on the campaign and fighting in the campaign for the candidates he was supporting, I would say his performance was very, very good. His base is real and strong, and it's enough to see him through to win in 2020, particularly if he learns the lessons from the places that the Republicans did poorly this time, including raising money, which we'll talk about in a bit, as well as performance with women and in the suburbs. But again, the Senate control gives the Republicans a stronger position when it comes to appointments, both for the administration and court appointments, which is going to be extremely important over the next couple of years. Let's look at the important characteristics, what we learned from this vote. There was no blue wave. At various times, people have been hoping for a Democratic wave, and that wave didn't happen. What you had was real trench warfare with a lot of candidates who were willing to take the time to attend to the real nuts and bolts of both campaigns and governance, I think really performing well at the polls. You know, after the 2016 election, you saw the Sanders Democrats and a lot of Democrats at the grassroots sort of take it as a wake-up call and challenge to go to work at the nuts and bolts. And I think the Democrats on the ground have done a very good job of that and finding and fielding good candidates. The other thing that happened was money, lots and lots of money. The Wall Street Journal had a good editorial today called The Democratic Money Tsunami. Democratic House candidates this cycle raised $951 million as of October 17th, the most recent reporting cutoff, according to figures from OpenSecrets.org. That's nearly 50% more than Republicans. 45% of donations to these Democratic campaigns came from out of state, compared with 34% for the GOP. Of the 34 red districts at last count that flipped blue Tuesday, the Democrats outraised the Republican in all but seven. So there's no doubt there was a wave of money. As I said, I think the Democrats did a good job on the ground. They did a very poor job at the national strategy. You know, I think it took a lot of money to buy their way out of some of the damage that a poor national strategy did. Women played a very important role. There were 3,784 women on the ballot. As of Thursday, 101 women had won House seats, breaking the current session's record of 84 women. A handful of races are still undecided, including one between two women in California, so I would expect that number of 101 to go higher. 16 women ran in the gubernatorial races in 17 states, 9 of the women won. Of the 23 women running for Senate seats, 13 won. In total, at least 117 women will serve in the House and Senate, which slightly raises the overall female representation in Congress from 20% to 22%. The elected female representatives are overwhelmingly Democrats. Together, they account for about 18% of the Congress, while Republican women only account for 4%. As I said, big money spent on this campaign. Let me just read. Center for Responsive Politics projected that a total of more than $5.2 billion was spent by campaigns leading up to the elections, and 2018 is projected to be the most expensive elections in U.S. history, breaking the previous record from 2016 of $4.4 billion. There were plenty of symptoms of voter fraud. Greg Palast has been covering some of them. It looks like we may be even in for a Florida recount. It looks like it could turn into quite a mess down in Florida. If you look at breakdowns of the urban, suburban, and rural voters, the Republicans got the rural voters, the Democrats got the urban voters. Unfortunately for the Republicans, Democrats did much better than they did in the presidential in 2016 in the suburbs. My guess is that Trump's style doesn't play well with some of the educated voters in the suburbs. And in fact, you saw comments by the president right before the election that maybe he should tone it down a little bit. But I think Trump's got a real style problem with in the suburbs, and that's going to be one of the questions coming out of this election. How does he change that? And clearly Democrats have a problem with labor, their longstanding constituents, and in the rural areas. It looks like the Democrats are going to continue to go with their elderly generation in the House to put back into leadership positions from Pelosi to Maxine Waters to Elijah Cummings. A Gallup poll indicates that Democrat voters do not want Pelosi to return to the Speaker's office, but my guess is Washington politics are going to end up engineering it that way. So you basically kind of put the dinosaurs in the leadership position, and that's very much going to hurt the Democrats' 2020 chances. If anything, they need to, all their strongest young people, they need to breed up fast if they're going to be real contenders in 2020. The threats of House investigations began literally the moment the elections results started coming in. The reality is, if you look at how much corruption there is in Washington on both sides of the fence, but certainly on the Democrat, the best defense is a good offense. I believe this was a global election, and one of my big questions is how much money was really coming from global allies who want to make sure the Democrats are strong enough to stop as power turns over in the United States. It's turning over all across the globe. And so you have numerous global allies, including people who were involved in the coup, who want to make sure that the Democrats stay in place to protect them against any transparency or enforcement that could happen related to the financial coup d'etat. We'll talk a lot more about that during the annual wrap-up with when we go see Dr. Farrell at the end of December. The red versus blue divide is deeper to me. I've been in New York squabbling with people about politics, just sort of trying to understand what their thinking is. Frankly, I think the mind control is so powerful, it almost takes your breath away. There was a survey that was tweeted out by Pew Research right after the election, and I retweeted it. You can see it on my Twitter feed. But they showed sort of the religious polls of how the voting broke down. And it's very interesting. The vote on the Catholics was 50-50 Democrat-Republican. After that, it was very interesting. People who believed in Jesus voted Republican. People who didn't voted Democrat. So you had basically very high percentages of atheists and Jews voting for the Democrats, and very high percentages of people who described themselves as Christians voting for the Republicans. I thought that was an interesting breakdown, but you can see it. See the tweet from Pew Research, which I retweeted on my Twitter feed. The economy is relatively strong. You almost had to ask the question if there's this much disagreement and tension when the economy is relatively good, what happens when and if it's not? It was interesting. There was a New York Times editorial this morning. I went down to get coffee in the lobby this morning, and there was complimentary New York Times. And there was an editorial saying that Democrats need a rural strategy. And I thought, what an empty way to think about this. The Democrats need to go meet the people in the rural areas and listen to the people in the rural areas and give a damn about them. And then, and only then, can you even think of having a political strategy. But to have a political strategy before you know them, listen to them, or care about them. You know, nobody who requires people in rural Tennessee to have a transgender bathroom policy care about them or listen to them or value their time. Key issues were that for the Democrats, healthcare. They did a very effective job of pounding home healthcare issues, as well as the importance of covering pre-existing conditions. The GOP tried to focus on economy and their success at tax reform and immigration. You know, what I think really happened is Mr. Global voted for gridlock. What was the most frightening thing for me about the election was there was complete denial of reality. No discussion of neocons pushing for war. No discussion of $21 trillion missing from the federal government. No discussion of what's really going on in space around us. No discussion of the ionization of the sky. No discussion of the build-out of a one-way mirror or the potential for the loss of reserve currency status and how we cope with that. no discussion of the problem with dual citizenship passports in the leadership of the country, and on and on and on. So the message is gridlock's going to be great for corporations and black budget players. It just gives them more power vis-a-vis the government. Anyway, as one of our very astute members of the Sillery team said today on the roundup, you know, this really underscores the importance of us individually living a free and inspired life and figuring out what we can do and how we can do it, because we're not going to get the change we want by working through government. We can get the change we want by taking action in our own life and making sure we're resilient and successful no matter which way this goes. And I cannot stress that enough, because I think for many people who had hoped that they could get a real result during this election process, there's no point in being dismayed. I mean, one of the causes of dismay, there's no doubt about it, is you're seeing people beginning to realize that the hope porn, you know, QAnon is hope porn and that's it. So the QAnon story has little chance of coming true. Money in markets, the U.S. dollar now up 4.34% for the year. The Fed came out today after 2 days of meetings and rates held steady, but they underscored they will bump their fourth bump of the year in December, and I believe them. Fixed income, the long treasury is down 9.32%. That's the long treasury ETF. The intermediate's down 3.69%. Bond aggregate is down 2.66 and junk down 0.82%. This year has been a bit rough. You know, if you look at traditional strategies of people when the stock market starts to go down, moving to bonds, when bonds and stocks are going down together, makes it a little bit rough. Equities, as I said, I think gridlock, political gridlock, will be good for corporate earnings. We're also coming into that part of the year where the vast majority of market gains occur, and that's November to June. You know, the old adage, sell in May and go away. Well, November to June is the period when really a vast majority historically of the U.S. equity market capital gains occur. The S&P now up 6.5% for the year. Home builders not moving with the S&P. They're still down 20.28% for the year. The Europe VGK ETF down 8.15%. Germany down 14.75%. Developed markets minus North America down 7.4%. China down 10%. So that's an improvement. That's the large cap. Small caps down 15.72% and emerging markets down 13.37%. Commodities now moving into a more bearish area, down 1.33% for the commodities index. Gold down 6.36%, silver down 15.2%, now oil up 8.26% for the year. Well, it wasn't a surprise, but Attorney Jeff Sessions was resigned day after election. His resignation letter doesn't have a date on it, so I suspect it's been in the president's desk for a while. Jim Acosta, the unbelievably rude reporter from CNN, lost his White House privileges after sort of an interaction with the president and a White House intern during the first press conference after the election. One thing the president made very clear is if the House wants to go to subpoena and investigation war, he intends to play hardball. And so long as he has an attorney general in place who knows how to play hardball and he can trust, you know, it'll be very interesting. Now, if you look at his appointment of an acting attorney general, the gentleman who was the chief of staff to Jeff Sessions, what he's basically done is knocked Rod Rosenstein, the deputy, out of the position of overseeing the Mueller investigation, which, of course, has the Democrats all up in arms. But from everything I see, he's got the legal power to do it. And frankly, it's the right kind of thing for the president to do. The Mueller investigation, the president during his press conference described it as a hoax. And I think that's given what has come out in the last year, that is not an unfair description. And so I think it's time for a real attorney general, or at least somebody properly acting as acting to oversee it. Amazon has indicated that their new headquarters will in fact be two headquarters, one according to the Wall Street Journal in Long Island City and the other in Northern Virginia. Amazon hasn't confirmed that as final. If that is the case, it emphasizes my theory that Amazon is going to be critical to reengineering the government if they're putting major new installations right next to the New York Fed and payment systems for the New York Fed is depository for the U.S. government in New York, and right next to Washington, D.C., where the Treasury and DOD, well, DOD is in Northern Virginia. There you have it. So basically, it appears Amazon's going to plop down major installations right next to the two places where all the federal payment and money flows occur. So it says to me Amazon's getting ready to help re-engineer the federal government. They're not the only one. Google has reported a significant expansion in its New York City presence. And in the meantime, the top headline in the Wall Street Journal this evening is Apple boosts land holdings over 7,000 acres. iPhone maker triples U.S. property purchases for data centers during the past 2 years. You know, it's very interesting as the cloud gets built out, all of these companies have a vested interest in sucking up as much data. And the customer, and this has been this certainly the Google model for a long time, the customer is no longer the customer, their prey. Bill Gates 2 weeks ago announced that Common Core has failed. And I just want to say thank you to Dr. Joseph Farrell, Anthony Cody, who joined us in this Slear report. You can find the interview on Common Core in the archive. But I also think we have to give thanks to Donald Trump, who contributed mightily to the defeat of Common Core, as well as Betsy DeVos. And that's something that is going to win a lot of favor for the current administration and gratitude. To have Gates say publicly that it failed is quite something. There's a lot going on in payment systems that I'm not going to talk about tonight, but we will talk about them more before the quarter is over. The Iranian sanctions are insisting, the Treasury is insisting that Iran and its banks come off the SWIFT system. That's a very painful thing. We know the Europeans are working on alternatives. Russia has an alternative SWIFT system. All of this is jeopardizing the power and liquidity of the U.S. financial markets, but it's a short-term game for what I consider to be long-term pain. Then the Bank of England is refusing to send Venezuela its own gold, if you can imagine that. The day after the election, I was sitting on a roundup. We have twice a week, the Solari team meets on a roundup, and the people focused on IT were talking about the extraordinary outages we were having all over the United States. So they pulled up the outage chart, which we've put into the money and markets commentary. You can see it there. And it had, of course, the shadows in the areas where the outages were occurring. And I said, you know, I hate to tell you guys, but that's a map of the Federal Reserve banks. Sure enough, it was all the areas where the nodes in the U.S. payment systems come together. I thought that was a remarkable coincidence. You can take a look at it at the bottom of the money and markets commentary. Financial Times points out tonight that Lloyd Blankfein, former chairman of Goldman Sachs, was the banker identified in court papers as having met with the man at the heart of the IMDb scandal in 2009. If that's the case, and Lloyd Blankfein really gets dragged into any liability as part of the scandal, it's interesting because Blankfein was such a leader of the financial coup d'etat. And, you know, talk about somebody who knows where all the bodies are buried. So throwing Blankfein into jail is going to be an extraordinary exercise in knowledge management. It's hard to believe they'll pull it off, but let's see what happens. Our hero this evening is Erwin Bach, who is someone I've been a long admirer of Erwin Bach. He is a very successful record and music producer, German-born, lives in Switzerland. He is also Tina Turner's husband and has been. They've been living together for, as if man and wife, for many, many decades, although they only recently got officially married. He, from everything I know, is a person of very high integrity, and it's a, if you look at the story of Erwin Bach and Tina Turner, it's a, it reminds you the importance, if you're going to get married, please marry somebody of high integrity. I think one of the reasons that Tina Turner, who's now 78, has led a long life, as opposed to someone like Whitney Houston, is she did a very good job of choosing someone of extraordinary both integrity and competency. And I suspect it's added a few decades to her life compared to some of the other extraordinary rock and roll celebrities whose personal lives have left them open to exploitation by the industry. I just wanted to read the following note from Wikipedia to explain why Bach is the hero tonight. In 2013, 3 weeks after her wedding to Erwin Bach, again, they'd been living as man and wife for many decades, Tina Turner suffered a stroke and had to learn to walk again. In 2016, she was diagnosed with intestinal cancer. Turner opted for homeopathic remedies to treat her high blood pressure that caused her condition to worsen, resulting in kidney failure. Her chances of receiving a kidney were low, and she was urged to start dialysis. Turner considered assisted suicide and signed up to be a member of Exit, but Bach offered to donate a kidney for her transplant, which took place on April 7th, 2017. And as we know, she's alive and well today. So an extraordinary person, an extraordinary man, and the husband of a very extraordinary woman. Let's go to the movies. I have recommended As It Is in Heaven before on the Slayer Report. I think this is the third time I've recommended and Let's Go to the Movies, but I keep discovering there's so many subscribers that don't know it. It's a Swedish film. It offers delightful insights about music and inspiration and changing times. I'm loath to tell you anything about it because I really want you to watch it. Some subscribers tell me they don't like, watching foreign movies with English subtitles. But if you don't mind that, it's I'm telling you, it's just a gem of a movie. And I think it's always wonderful to watch movies that have not only serious, serious insights about the world, but also are very inspiring. And you finish watching them and feel totally rejuvenated. But I'm telling you, get out the Kleenex box. And that's the guys too. Everybody needs Kleenex after they watch As It Is in Heaven. But I'm telling you, you'll finish it feeling very inspired and very energized. Our interview tonight is our quarterly discussion with Saker. It was a very juicy, rich interview. You have to listen to it. And so I'm going to speed up through Money and Markets because I really want you to have the time to listen to it. And we talk a lot more about the serious, serious risks going on in the back and forth, you know, and it's one of the reasons why more stupid investigations by the Democrats, which only helped serve to start World War III, are a terrible idea. But I'll leave the discussion to Saker and me. The Saker's more worried about an actual war. I'm more worried that, you know, that the drumbeats of war will be used to waste global resources on, on military budgets and arms. But I'll leave it to you to listen to the discussion and decide. Very juicy conversation. Ask Catherine. Hi, Catherine. My question for tonight is related to monitoring one's financial identity and personal finances. In the corporate world, it's common to hire a third party to provide such services for the company and key executives. Do you have any recommendations for individuals? What are your thoughts on a company such as LifeLock or others? Also, I believe in the past interview, you mentioned you had your credit card locked as a protection against fraud. Can you elaborate on what you mean by locked? Thank you. Here's my message. You need to do it yourself And you need to do it in concert with a really good bookkeeper if you have one, or accountant if you have one. And it's one of the reasons you need a really good bank. So let me step through the important things. First of all, you need an honest bank who has great personalized customer service. So I can be anywhere in the world, and I tell the story of 2 years ago, walking down the street in Verona, and the phone rings, and it's my bank, National Bank of Malvern, in Malvern, Pennsylvania. And the banker's laughing, and she says, "We know it wasn't you, just charged $500 at Disney World in Paris." And I said, "That's right, cancel the card." And so they're just on top of things, and they know me, and they know to pick up the phone and call me anywhere in the world. So it's very, very important that you have a bank who's watching these things and will be communicating with you about them. It's one of the reasons also we have tight limits on the debit and credit cards. So if anything really happens, they're going to get shut off pretty fast. You know, so just particularly on the debit card, you know, before that cash leaves the bank, you want to just keep those tight limits on. You want to limit the number of accounts you have, because one of the things I'm going to tell you to do is you or your bookkeeper need to check them regularly. So the way to watch out for identity theft or fraud is to just be watching everything. One of the things we look for are tiny little bills. You know, they'll put through a $2 charge and we don't ignore it. We were right on it because we know, you know, that $2 charge is a test. And if you don't stop it, it could get bigger fast. I don't use services and I don't recommend services because I think the less people have your data, the better. And if you look at some of the services and who they're associated with, they're more scary than, you know, being naked and having nothing. What you mean when you say lock the credit, we have our credit frozen, so you can request that all three of the major credit agencies, you freeze your credit. And that means when somebody does a credit check, they can't get anything. Now, what that means is you're not going to get approved, and oftentimes we'll have to write. You have to do it in writing. You can't do it digitally and have the credit unfrozen. It's very cumbersome and time-consuming, but it means that no one can play any games with our credit because our credit's frozen, so they can't. If you study identity theft, unfrozen credit means they can do lots of things and get credit cards and other things before you know it. But it, when you're communicating on freezing your credit, check your credit always. You know, I try every year or two to get a credit report and really look at who's saying what, reporting what, and that's where you can always catch some things up. And then if there's something wrong or a mistake, you need to jump on it, because you never know when that incorrect data could lead to something much bigger that's going on. If you can, have an excellent CPA and attorney. So we have a CPA who files our taxes, somebody I've known for many, many years. You've heard them on the Salary Report, Patty Kemmerer. I've also had the same attorney for many, many years. You want to maintain those relationships before you need them. So take the time to create the relationships and make sure you have people of extraordinary integrity, because I'm telling you, in my experience, it can be the difference between life and death. Catherine, one of my best friends and mentors, just lost his home in Paradise, California, and like many, barely got out with his life, and he is in his 80s. My question is, what does Mr. Globaloney want with the rural foothills of the Sierras, or do you think they're just trying to empty out all of California? You know, my guess, and it's my guess, is they have very big plans for sort of Silicon Valley North and then development up and around Sacramento that can go, you know, it can go 100 miles north of Sacramento and then over into Reno. That land's very beautiful. There's a ton of great water. So I think, and again, as I said, I think they're going to bring in a lot of manufacturing and other operations from Asia, and they're going to bring in hundreds of thousands of well-educated Asian professionals, and they need, you know, whether it's first homes or second homes, there's going to, that they need land for a lot of a lot of functions. So unfortunately, I'm sorry about your friend, but I think you're going to have large sections of California where these kinds of things are happening. And unfortunately, I believe they're going to move into the heartland eventually. Oh, and early this morning, his wife had posted a red alert for the area, along with a notice saying PG&E was going to turn off the power in Paradise in case of fire, but it hadn't started yet, at least not that anyone knew. Unfortunately, it sounds like they're getting more brazen about this. I realize that sometimes things are just coincidences, but I saw one man interviewed saying something like that it already turned the power off so we couldn't get water out of the well to fight the fire, and we couldn't get any information on the news about what was happening either because we had no power. It's a reminder to me I really do need to get, I do have a generator, but I really need to make sure I have proper backup for the well. I thought that was interesting. Any thoughts? As I said, I think they're getting more brazen. Interestingly enough, there's several articles about Trump making a comment at one of his cabinet meetings about shutting off money to California because the wildfires are the result of improper care of the forests. Given what's really going on, you just can't imagine what a sort of foolish, evil comment that was. But I would say that the tensions between Trump and California after the election are only going to get worse. Then they continue, let us not hang the crepe so sorely around the elections. The donkey has gained a slight majority in the House and worsened its deficit in the Senate. In the undecided races totaling 22, R leads D by 14-6 in current count. This predicts a 228-207 majority for the sentient Nancy Pelosi. With such a slight congressional margin, some bipartisan cooperation will be required. This doesn't necessarily solve our problems, but it's not the end of the world either. Stay tuned for that and work to hold it off. I cried because I had no shoes. Then I saw a man who had no feet. Well, I think, yes, you have, even though the Republicans have more of a margin in the Senate, both sort of Democratic leadership in the House and Republican leader in the Senate is not, you know, it's slight. I think slight is a fair description on both sides. And so, yes, it would require more bipartisan cooperation. But if you look at the way things were going in the last 24 hours, I don't see that cooperation happening. One of the things that would help cooperation tremendously is if we could get out of denial on the 10 most important issues. But as I described earlier, the defining characteristic of this election was our refusal as a society to face reality. And that describes everybody from most voters all the way up to the Congress and the president. We're all trying to stay within the official reality. And of course, life doesn't make sense within the official reality. You know, so things are getting more and more bizarre. Okay, that's it for November 8th. Coming up next week, we'll have the last part of the third quarter 2018 wrap-up, Megacities and the Growth of Global Real Estate Companies. Then on November 22nd, the next installment of Food Series, our next interview with Harry Blaser interviewing Bill Nyman on poultry, very appropriate for Thanksgiving week. And then November 20th, Bill Binney comes back with his colleague Kirk Wiebe. They're going to be talking about their exciting new venture, Pretty Good Knowledge. We also have a whole series of interviews I did in Europe, which we'll be publishing as special reports along the way. So please remember, until next week when we finish up with Megacities, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.